Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
26.2 miles, and then things got bad. We begin today with the explosions at the end of the Boston Marathon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, everybody, the 15th of April. Good, as always, to have you with us. It is tax day today, which kind of goes without saying, but more to the point, it's Patriots Day in Massachusetts, the traditional day for the running of the Boston Marathon. As you've heard by now, there were two explosions near the finish line of the race this afternoon, right in downtown Boston. Kurt Nickisch from WBUR has been working on the story all day. Kurt, thanks for being here.
Of course.
This is among the highest profile events there are in Boston, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the Boston Marathon is held on what is maybe the most important state holiday, Patriots Day, the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord. And I tweeted this morning, it's the best day to be in Boston because it's such a big event here.
As such, I imagine a massive tourist attraction, huge crowds at the finish line there.
Yeah, fortunately, the explosions happened very late in the race. So normally, Boylston Street going down past where these two explosions happened is very dense with runners. This was hours after the winners actually went through, and the crowd of runners was thinning out pretty well. So it wasn't as densely packed with people as it might have been a few hours earlier.
For those who aren't familiar with Boston, tell us what Boylston Street is like. Small businesses, large department stores, what is it?
This is like a big shopping street coming right down into Copley Square. So there are boutique hotels. The Boston Public Library is right there, the oldest public library in the country. The Apple Store is just a few blocks down. I mean, it's a high rent, but also highly trafficked and just a big commercial street in Boston.
I imagine now for a couple of days anyway, it will be, if not shut down, then severely restricted.
For sure.
Yeah. You crossed the route, I understand, of the marathon to get back to the studio today.
Yeah, I did, and there were folks who were going in both directions. There were some people running and a few people still cheering them on, but other people walking back up Beacon Street before it jogs a few times and joins Boylston Street a little further down. And there were people walking back up the street, ears to their cell phones, tears to their eyes. So it was a kind of an odd scene because some runners were stopping. Buses were headed their way to help take runners back to where they needed to go.
As you keep tabs on things there at the station at WBUR, Kurt, what do you hear from the American Red Cross, first responders, and all of that about what they're asking people to do?
Well, they've been asking people to leave that area because there were reports of suspicious devices, and police were basically pleading with everybody to get out of the way. Of course, the gravity of the Boston Marathon is everybody running downhill into Boston to get down to that area. So they were sending buses into the area to take people away, but it's obviously not an easy scene to clear quickly.
Yeah. Kurt Nickisch at WBUR in Boston about the marathon bombings today. Kurt, thanks a lot.
Sure thing, Kai.
On Wall Street today, grim to match the mood, although I got to tell you, stocks were down even before the race, so bear that in mind. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lots of I-dotting and T-crossing going on right now on Capitol Hill as the big immigration reform bill gets ready for its big reveal. One of the last issues that does seem to have finally been worked out is what to do about farm workers. Of the million or so farm workers nationwide, somewhere between half and 80% of them are thought to be here illegally. So from the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark has more now on what immigration compromise might look like down on the farm.
I caught Peter Osterkamp between chores this morning.
We got to run through a bunch of fertilizer bills, and then I got to go check onions and sugar beets and whatnot.
Osterkamp is a fourth-generation farmer in Southern California with about 30 employees. He says he decided the current immigration system was broken when he wanted to promote a temporary worker into a full-time job.
So bright, so intelligent and willing to work so hard.
But the guy had entered the U.S. illegally. Osterkamp tried to get a work visa for him.
And I went and spent hours. The answer was always, sorry, you know, there's nothing you can do.
That would change under the current proposal. Farm workers already here without documents would be eligible to apply for temporary legal status if they stay in agriculture for 5 years. That would be good for farmers and their workers, says United Farm Workers spokeswoman Diana Tellefson-Torres.
They're not going to have to think about, well, I don't have my documents, and so I can't speak about when there are injustices at the workplace.
The compromise would also increase the number of new visas open to immigrant farm workers each year and allow those workers to change employers. That raises questions for Philip Martin, an immigration economist at UC Davis.
What's going to prevent me from going and working in construction as opposed to agriculture because I can make more money? Now, in theory, my work permit is only good for agriculture, but I don't know exactly how we're going to monitor that.
That's just one of the details in the proposal that could send unknown ripple effects through the economy. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
You don't build a multi-billion dollar company without a certain vision, so we kind of have to take it as a given that Charles Ergen, the CEO of Dish Network, has a plan for what he wants to do with Sprint's Nextel. Ergen and Dish have offered $25.5 billion to buy the wireless company, which, it's worth pointing out right about here, already has a buyout offer on the table from a Japanese company. Sprint is a distant third, a very distant third, behind Verizon and AT&T. So what's the big attraction? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Dish CEO Charles Ergen compared his company's bid for Sprint to an episode of Seinfeld, a seemingly random series of events that ties together in the end. After all, Dish Network is a TV company, and Sprint is in the phone business. Still, Scott Cleland sees the connection. He heads telecom research firm Precursor.
It would make both companies stronger.
Cleland says Dish's Ergen is hungry for more broadband capacity, and Sprint has a lot of it.
He sees an opportunity to have a bundled offering of satellite TV and wireless broadband and voice service.
The triple threat. AT&T and Verizon have a head start, but acquiring Sprint could make Dish a contender, says consultant Chetan Sharma.
By combining the two companies, they get a scale of close to an AT&T and Verizon to diversify and expand their business.
Sharma says the Sprint deal could allow Dish to stay nimble at a time when the industry is in flux. No one knows how we'll be consuming media in 5 years, but we do know it will involve wireless. Sprint is in the middle of a merger deal with a Japanese company. But analyst Scott Cleland says you shouldn't rule out Dish's Charles Ergen.
He has built a company from nothing by playing his poker chips very well.
In addition to being a Seinfeld fan, Ergen was a professional poker player.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's a handful of economists, maybe a dozen, maybe two, that are recognizable right away by name. Raj Chetty probably isn't one of them. He was, just by way of background, the youngest tenured professor in the history of the economics department at Harvard. Now, at the age of 33, he's got a MacArthur Genius Award to his credit. And this past Friday, he won the John Bates Clark Medal, given by the American Economic Association to the best economist in the country under the age of 40. Winning the Clark Medal, by the way, has a positive correlation with winning the Nobel Prize in Economics later on in life. So, now that you know a little bit about him, here with a quick primer on his work, which may strike closer to home than you realize. Marketplace's David Weinberg has it.
I want you to think of the last trip you made to the grocery store. When you looked at the price of shampoo, for example, did you calculate what it would cost after taxes?
So the traditional assumption in economics is that you are keeping such taxes in mind when you make purchasing decisions.
Raj Chetty wanted to test that assumption, so he set up an experiment. He went to a large grocery store chain in California and asked if he could put special price tags on items.
We added these tags that said $7.99 plus California sales tax equals whatever the price of the item was.
But the owners limited the experiment to hair care and cosmetics. They assumed the price tags would cause customers to buy less. This assumption is the opposite of what traditional economic theory tells us. It turns out, though, that the store owners were right.
We ended up finding that demand for these products fell by roughly 8 or 10%. So it was as if everybody was ignoring the tax before we put these tags on.
What sets Chetty apart from his colleagues is that he comes up with creative ways of using data to understand how the economy works. Henry Aaron is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
Some people have a real eye for interesting data sets and questions. And when you marry those two, you get results to which people pay attention. I think that's been the case with Raj Chetty.
For policymakers, Chetty's studies of real-life economic behavior could be a very useful tool. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Venezuelans decided over the weekend, decided narrowly, I should add, to continue Hugo Chavez's revolution. Chavez's hand-picked successor, Nicolas Maduro, beat out Enrique Capriles, an opponent known for being somewhat more pro-business than Maduro is. The election has not been without controversy, vote rigging, and outright fraud among the numbers. But beyond the politics, there is the question of the economy and what today's election may or may not mean there. Daniel Ducanal is a blogger and small business owner in Yaracuy. That's about 200 miles west of Caracas. Daniel, good to have you with us.
Good to receive me. Thank you.
What would you say, Daniel, is the mood today in Caracas?
Well, nobody called me from Caracas this morning, believe it or not, and that I interpret that as a general depression among all my acquaintances in Caracas. It's rather quiet everywhere.
Huh.
And that also happened last year when Chavez was reelected. On that Monday, it was more like a funeral mood than any victory celebration.
So let's say the unexpected happens after this recount that you guys are going to have, and Capriles somehow wins. It's not like he can just turn this around like that, though, Daniel, can he?
Oh, no, he can't, as a businessman. I know that we're in big, big trouble, and whoever was going to win the election was going to be faced with very tough choices. The difference is Capriles winning, he would have stopped a lot of the gifts that he gives, especially to Cuba, which is at least in the order of $10 billion. There is also a lot of places where Capriles would cut spending without any trouble, like, for example, arms weapon purchases, which are big and absolutely unnecessary for Venezuela, just a major source of graft and corruption. So just by doing those measures, Capriles would be able not to balance the budget, but at least to make it more manageable.
Talk to me about regular people for a second. When you go to the supermarket, for instance, what's on the shelves? Can you get what you need?
No. If I want to have access to everything, I need to go to at least two or three stores. There is always going something missing of the main items in a given store. And now we are basically headed towards some kind of system of rationing.
So you blog, of course, as we noted, but you also run a business there, a small business. How is the environment there? I mean, how are you doing?
Right now, we're in an economic crisis because we have gone out from two back-to-back devaluations. So in other words, all whatever small profits my business did last year have been completely wiped out. And actually, I'm right now in debt and we're in the obligation to reduce our payrolls.
As a businessman, Daniel, you are, I suppose, obliged to be optimistic, right? You have to believe that your products are going to sell. And yet, by your own account, you have an economic crisis. The country is polarized politically. Inflation is high. How can you be optimistic if you actually are?
Well, it's this is something that sometimes people don't understand, is that you do have an obligation to your employees. I mean, I can be extremely depressed, but I still need to go and fight because I need to meet payroll. It is also not made it easier because about half of my employees are Chavistas, but I try to avoid any political talk at work, which so for me is kind of difficult, I have to admit, but I do it successfully. We are there to survive because it's just a sense of responsibility. So I have to pretend I am optimistic no matter what.
Daniel Ducanel, he's a blogger and a small businessman. He sells agricultural supplies in Yaracuy, Venezuela. Daniel, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Straight ahead, you know what day it is, don't you?
It's not that big of a deal. It's just a bunch of numbers put together to come up with an end result.
No, it is a big deal, but hey, that guy was an accountant. First, though, let's do these numbers. All right, here's the way it played out. China's scorching growth slowed just enough to hex Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gave up 265 points, 1.8%, closed at 14,599. Let me pause here to acknowledge the wah-wah trombones, by the way. The NASDAQ dove 78 points, 2.3%, 3216. The number of the S&P 500 gave back 36 points, about 2.3% there as well. Ended things at 1552. China triggered the sell-off early this morning by reporting its economy grew 7.7% in the first quarter. The U.S., as we all know, would kill for that, but it did come in lower than expected, and that was enough to do it. ExxonMobil shares leaked 2.8% today. Chevron fell the same amount, helped drag down the Dow. Gold continued its downward spiral, recorded the biggest two-day loss in 30 years. That pulled down metal and mining company shares of Barrick Gold melted 12.5% today. We told you about that Dish Network bid for Sprint. Nextel Sprint shares rang up more than 13% today. Dish surrendered 2.2%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Labor Department issues its monthly Consumer Price Index. It tells us if consumers paid more or less for stuff in March than they did in February. The Commerce Department reports on new home construction for March. And the annual National Food Policy Conference concludes in Washington. Topics on this year's agenda include the future of food shopping and addressing the problem of food waste. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our education correspondent, Amy Scott, has spent a lot of time in Cincinnati, Ohio, since the beginning of the school year, a place called Lower Price Hill in particular, and a school called Euler. Euler is not a school that's traditionally had a strong reputation. Not a lot of kids finished high school, let alone college. And Amy's been looking at how administrators and teachers there have been trying to change that, getting more kids to graduate and break the cycle of poverty that is endemic in that neighborhood. So today, one of the students and her bumpy road to graduation. Here's Amy.
It's recruit day at Penn State Greater Allegheny. Promising high school athletes have been invited to check out the small campus just outside Pittsburgh. A dozen or so students and their parents file into a classroom for a Q&A with professors.
And we're not part of the glossy brochure thing.
That's right.
So, we'll give you the true answer.
From the sea of expectant faces, a hand pops up from a pretty brown-haired girl in a hot pink blazer and artfully torn jeans.
How good is your math program here?
How good is the math program here? Well,
the question is from Raven Gribbins, an 18-year-old senior from Euler High School in Cincinnati. She wants to be a math teacher. It would be hard to overstate how far Raven has come to get here. I don't just mean the six-hour drive from Cincinnati with her dad and basketball coach, or that the school principal had to dip into some funds from donors to pay for the gas and hotel. Just a few years ago, when this video popped up on YouTube, Raven going to Penn State would have seemed unlikely.
Raven, get her! Come back after her!
That's Raven in a street fight with another girl. The woman egging her on is her aunt. Raven's temper flared up at school, too. She's worked hard to rein it in.
I knew I wasn't going to graduate if I kept up with my smart mouth and my attitudes and getting in trouble in school and stuff. It wasn't going to get me nowhere.
And she wants to go somewhere. Raven grew up in Lower Price Hill, or 8th and State, as the locals call it. A lot of the families have roots in the coal mining towns of Kentucky and West Virginia. Over the years, poverty and drugs have eroded what had been a close-knit working-class neighborhood. Both of Raven's parents have struggled with addiction and been in and out of jail, especially her mom.
When I was in, 9th and 10th grade, every time she got in trouble and went to jail, I got in trouble in school and got suspended. But now I realize that I can't live her life for her. She's going to make her own choices, so I can't worry about her no more. I got to worry about myself.
She's the epitome of what our young ladies go through down here.
That's Raven's basketball coach at Euler, Joe Saylor. He grew up in the neighborhood.
One day she might have her drug-addicted aunt's kids taking care of them, raising them, and the next day she'll be here playing basketball just like a normal high school student in any town USA.
Just the fact that there is a high school is a big part of Raven's story. When her dad and Joe Saylor were at Euler, it only went to sixth grade. Most kids didn't want to leave the neighborhood for high school, so they dropped out. Then 7 years ago, Euler added a high school, and eventually team sports and prom, the things that keep kids interested in school. Seniors are paired up with mentors to help them graduate. Next month, Raven will be the first in her family to finish high school.
Someone has to be the one to break that cycle of not being educated and living in poverty. And our students here at Euler are doing that. We have first-generation college students coming out of our high school every year. And it's not a mystery. It's Euler. Euler is why that's happening.
For Raven, a change of scenery helped. This year, she moved out of the neighborhood, where she'd been living with her grandmother since she was 9.
Like, people were getting shot down here, and every time you go outside, there's a drug deal going on.
She's back with her dad, Mike Gribbins, in a quieter part of town. He's been sober now for more than 5 years. He goes to Raven's games, gets on her about her homework. Under his watch, she's brought her grades up from mostly C's to mostly A's.
This is probably the only year that I'm going to have, you know, to spend it with my daughter. So I kind of feel lucky, you know, that I got this opportunity.
Hearing him say this stuff, it means a lot because now I know he actually does care. And a daughter needs a father in her life.
So last weekend, father and daughter and coach piled into a car and drove 300 miles to McKeesport, Pennsylvania. Raven plays volleyball, too. The coach at Penn State Greater Allegheny spotted her on a recruiting website and emailed her out of the blue. Raven got to stay in a dorm and tour the campus and show off her volleyball skills in the gym.
Stop it!
As they get ready to head back to Cincinnati, Coach Saylor asks Raven how she liked it.
To me, this place
I think
it
would be
you.
Good for me. It's a small campus. There's really nice people. The coach is nice.
But it's by no means a done deal. Raven hasn't actually been accepted yet. She just took the ACT for the third time, hoping to raise her score. Then there's the question of how to pay for it, whether she'll get enough financial aid. And even then, Saylor says, can she make the break?
What scares me is that if she gets an opportunity to go away to college, will she take it? Because you always feel like you're being pulled back into your family's drama. And I've seen that over and over and over.
For now, Raven's just worn out from her adventure. She grabs her pillow out of the trunk and settles in for the long ride home. In McKeesport, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can hear all of Amy's stories about Euler School at our website. It's marketplace.org. Today is Had It Escaped Your Notice Somehow Tax Day. Not to fear, though. There's hours left till midnight. You know, chances are taxes weren't the most fun you've had so far this year. But just for a change of pace, here's somebody who has a different feeling about them.
My name's Bruce McFarland. I'm a tax preparer. I'm originally from Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma, home of the Sooners, go Sooners. I'm currently practicing in Kansas City, Missouri. The best part of my job is being able to show people that having your taxes prepared by a professional is not a tense thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not a horrible thing. It's the kind of thing that you can go, you know you're going to get treated correctly. You're going to get the most for your money and that they're calm. Everybody stresses about this dreaded tax thing and it's not that big of a deal. It's just a bunch of numbers put together to come up with an end result. If you walk into my office, it's pretty 1960s. I've got a piggy bank that looks like a 1960s hippie bus with a surfboard on top of it. I have a poster from Woodstock in my office. I have a ponytail that's about 12 inches long. I don't wear a tie. I don't wear suits. The most awesome thing that I hear from everybody is my buddy's taxes. He got $4,000 back. How come I'm only getting $2,000 back? No two tax returns are the same. I don't care how close you are to your buddy, how close you are to your neighbor's situation. Every tax return is different. A client brought in a 4x4 foot bucket full of receipts. Two bags that were about 3 feet in diameter, full of receipts. They weren't sorted. They were all wadded up.
And the first words out of her mouth were, "Do you think we're going to have to file an extension?" I was like, "Really?" I told her that my staff, who is diligently working right now, sorting these receipts out, I told her we'll try our best to get it done on time. Because I personally hate extensions. I want to have 8 months off.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the 15th of April, a statement from Representative Dave Camp, Republican of North Carolina, that I'm just going to read. It takes the average American taxpayer, Mr. Camp said, 13 hours to comply with the tax code, gathering receipts, reading the rules, and filling out forms the IRS requires. The tax code, he goes on, forces Americans to spend more than $168 billion to comply and 6 billion hours. The Washington Post did some fact-checking. Turns out Representative Camp is pretty much right on the money, which you kind of knew in your gut now, didn't you? Speaking of which, I have to go call my accountant. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow, well, it gave back 265 points, about 1.8%. The NASDAQ dove 78 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 gave back the same thing percentage-wise, 2.3%, 36 points. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.